Hello and welcome. This is D. Garrett Nadeau presenting one of a number of podcasts on behalf of the Lancashire Authors Association. The purpose of these broadcasts is to discuss writers and various writing topics with an emphasis on Lancashire writing and writers, but including a broad range of subjects from all over England and regular musical interludes to vary your listening experience. My guest for this podcast is Neil White.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, Neil. Thank you for coming. We always often start with a little bit about your childhood and about your upbringing, and sort of tell us a little bit about where you grew up. And
Speaking to our Lancashire Authors Association, I'm actually from Yorkshire, and if you ask me where I live is Lancashire, where I'm from is Yorkshire. I grew up in Wakefield, left in the end of the 80s to go to university in Preston to do a law degree, and ended up staying there.
Right, okay. I've always thought about, because I did postgraduate study in Yorkshire, and so I know a little bit about Yorkshire and the Yorkshire people, and I, in my head, always kind of compare them to the American sort of pioneers out west, in that there's a certain attitude of independence and a certain need to be self-reliant. Would you say that you would agree with that in Yorkshire, that there is a kind of do you think that's part of your nature? Do you think that informs who you are?
I don't think so. I think in terms of the county, I think you're probably right, but only because it's such a huge geographical area, and
right.
You are brought up to be proud of being a Yorkshireman, if you like, or a Yorkshire woman.
Yeah,
so that is a definite part of your upbringing. But I suppose that probably counts for anywhere, whether you're a Mancunian, whether you're a Scouser, whether you're from Suffolk.
Yeah.
You're always proud of where you're from. But with Yorkshire being such a geographically large area, it incorporates so many things. You've got the industrial West Yorkshire and South Yorkshire. You've got the North Yorkshire, farming areas. You've got the coast. You've got so many parts of it. It does feel like a country all of its own right. But so I think it's partly a fluke of geography.
Right.
But there is that sense that you are brought up to be proud of where you're from. But then again, people from Lancashire are.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the terrain as well, because there's the Yorkshire moors and the dales, which is quite an isolated kind of region. I mean, it's not overpopulated, and it's a kind of rough, difficult area for farmers. I think the farming sort of would you define it as subsistence farming, or is it?
Well, for me, that isn't the Yorkshire that I know, really.
Right.
I mean, Wakefield's very much an industrial city.
It was
a mining city up until the miners' strike. So the Yorkshire that I grew up in was very much an industrial West Yorkshire, very much sort of a blue collar feel to it, you know, and it's certainly a long way from all the farming areas.
Right.
It's not James Herriot.
It's more sort of the Wakefield kind of like industrial side. So the mining thing is, what did your father do? Remind me what your father was doing.
My father worked in the shoe trade.
Right. Okay.
But his father was a colliery deputy manager. So there was a coal mining side, but not really many of my family were miners. We lived in areas where miners lived, and a lot of my friends at school had fathers who were miners, but there's no mine, no, apart from my grandfather, there's no real mining heritage in my family at all.
So what was primary school like for you? Would you say you enjoyed being in primary school, your elementary school education, or was that a kind of a rough time for you? Or?
No, certainly in Wakefield. It was a good school. It was actually, I lived on a fairly big council estate in Wakefield, so it wasn't perhaps the, looking back, it wasn't the best part of town, but it was actually quite a good area. It was right on the edge of the city, so it was quite near some, you know, open fields and some nice scenic areas. So you never felt you were in the middle of a city.
But most people think of council estates as being kind of rough.
You didn't find
that.
I think it was probably different in the 70s. In the 70s, it felt more just working class, but with emphasis on working rather than class. If you get me,
drift. No, yeah, I understand.
It was very sort of very blue collar, very strong work ethic, and certainly it never felt, when I was at school, it never felt like you were in any kind of deprived area. It was a good school, and in fact, when we left Wakefield when I was 12 to move to the East Coast, I felt I was slightly ahead in my education the school I went to. It was a good school. I enjoyed it. It was, you know, there was a lot of people read, you know, there was next to a library, And certainly the library was always busy. I was always at the library. I was always reading. You know, there was never.
So you were a strong reader even in primary school.
Oh, yeah. All through school, I was always reading. I'm not sure how many of my friends did, but I was always a strong reader as a child. Yeah.
Did you write as well, even when you were that young? Did you write little poems or stories or
not as a hobby. Not as a hobby, but I do know, I think probably when I was about 11, I started to realise that it was something I thought I could do. It was something that when I did any tests at school or mini exams at school, even at that age, it was something that I always seemed to do well in, get good marks in composition, that if I did longer essays, I felt it was something, if I had any talent at school, it was putting words on a page. Right. Not so good at, the sciences or games or maths, but I could always put words on a page, and that was always, I always thought that was one skill I had.
So was there any point when you feel you wrote your first story, your first bit of fiction? Was that later on, or did you kind of make up stories when you were a kid? Even in your head?
It's a hard one to answer because, I mean, looking back, I may have had a good imagination, but I don't know. I never know what's inside other people's heads. So I'm not sure if I have any kind of imagination that's unusual or exceptional, or it's just that everyone's like that. Mm. I used to play the fantasy games that everybody plays, and I don't think there was ever a moment when I sat down and thought, oh, I'm going to write a story. I like writing stories. As an adult, it always felt it was something I could do. And I wanted to do what I used to like writing. I used to like writing in an academic sense. And I used to like, it was something I thought I was able to do. I wanted to prove I could do it. It was more that kind of thing. And then, therefore, when it came to that step and this point,
did you do A levels before going to university?
Yeah, but quite late on.
What A levels did you do?
I did law and sociology.
Okay, right. Yeah. So nothing to do with writing.
Nothing at all. I mean, I was 24 when I did my A levels. I went to university quite late, and
did you have a job before that? Did you work then before you did your A levels?
Not really. I went to I left when I was 16. In fact, the only exam I had at that point was English. I passed my English, as it was then, my English O level, and I just drifted for about 6-7 years. Yeah. This was the middle of the '80s, and it's two ways to look at it. I could either say that unemployment then was high, and therefore it was hard to get a job, or perhaps I just enjoyed drifting, and it was somewhere to hide. I could hide amongst the big numbers, if you like, and feel all deprived look at me.
But you didn't take up writing then. During that period of time, you didn't. You were just.
I remember when I left home when I was 18, and the first flat I had was a little bed city type place. It was a bit grim looking back. But I remember when I first moved in, the lady who was there left a typewriter. Now, and she did come and collect it after about a month, but she left a typewriter. And I remember messing with it, and I remember just writing perhaps a paragraph, and I got quite a thrill out of seeing something that I'd put, I can't remember what I wrote, if it was a story or just a poem or something of that nature. And I remember thinking it was quite good to see something, some words I'd thought of looking like a printed book. Cause it was on a typewritten page. So I got quite a thrill out of that. I remember thinking, but nothing, I never thought beyond that. I was still reading a lot. Most of the music I liked then was very much works. I admire the lyrics of various people like Paul Weller and artists like him. But I never formed any real intention of, at that point, I really want to be a writer.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think we'll have a musical break now because you've chosen some music for us. And, the first tune that you've chosen, 5446 was my number. Toots and the Mate House.
Yeah.
I don't know that one at all.
Well, actually, it's sort of working back towards crime, crime friction. That's actually was Toots's prison number.
Oh, 5446. Okay.
And that's not why I've chosen it. It just reminds me of a certain period I spent a lot of time in the 80s going on scooter rallies, and I was into all the scooter sort of thing, and we used to go to seaside rallies all over the country and get up to all sorts of nefarious things, and it takes me back to that time when you used to go, you know, when they used to hire out a hall and they'd have old reggae and old ska and old Northern Soul blasting out of these really big distorted speakers. And it just takes me back to that time. So that's why I picked that. Not because it's my favourite song, but it always takes me back,
to
that moment in time.
Okay, well, let's listen to that then.
Sing it up, mister! Hear what I say, sir, yeah. No. Yeah. Get your hands in the air, sir! Woo! Yeah! Then you will get no hurt, mister! No. I said, yeah!
I said, yeah!
That was great. Thank you very much for that, Neil. But I'm going to have to ask you about the scooter thing, because this is not an American. I mean,
no.
we've got the Hell's Angels,
yeah.
And the bikes, their bikes are huge. These huge things that they roll around on and go around with sort of a bit of a reputation. But I was never part of that. I have a very poor sense of balance. I can't ride a bicycle. So the whole scooter thing is completely alien to me. So I'm going to need you to explain to me all about how you used to sort of. Can I say scoot round?
Yeah. Well, I suppose it was certainly something that was big in the '80s. It's still quite big now, but it's a bit of a carry on from the mod thing in the '60s.
I was going to say, were you a mod? Was it kind of a variation of that?
Well, I suppose I was into the mod kind of thing, and certainly a lot of the music I liked in the '70s was perhaps part of the mod revival, the post Quadrophenia.
Yeah,
kind of. I don't know if you've seen the Quadrophenia film. It sort of
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, led to a bit of a revival. But as the mod movement, if you call it that, sort of dwindled away, once it became a bit less fashionable, the scooter thing carried on. It was just basically thousands of lads who formed clubs, and we'd ride around, and we'd go to, and they'd hold 8 or 9, 10 rallies a year, and you'd all congregate en masse and get drunk. And
but to get back to your riding then, I'm just going to ask you whether that experience, have you ever kind of incorporated that into any of your books? Have you ever had a kind of a mod or a character who is into music in the same way, or has that ever filtered into your books? Or? Yeah,
well, the only character I've had who's ridden a scooter was a character in my fourth book, Dead Silence. And I just included a scooter just because I wanted to include one. But no, I've never based a story around that. I mean, cause now it seems, I remember when I sort of drifted away from it, it was when I started university. And I remember towards the end of the first year, I was at university, I was going back to Wakefield every weekend, and I was sort of mixing with the people there who were on scooters. Because I got to university, it felt like I'd moved away from it. So, and because now that's 25 years ago,
right,
it just seems so, it's like, almost like a different life. It was something I did when I was young. I really loved it, we had a great time. But it never to the point where I'd want to say, well, let's have a crime story setting a scooter rally, it was just something I did when I was young, I suppose. That's what
it's the same true about your childhood. Would you say, do any of your characters have similar childhoods, or do you find, I mean, I find when I write, for example, that I want to write about people who are not like me at all. So really, it has nothing to do. People ask me about autobiographical elements. I say there aren't any in what I write. Would you say you've got autobiographical elements in your work or not?
There are snippets, although I have been, I'm not sure if unlucky is the right word, but I remember when I wrote my first book, Fallen Idols, and that was back in, came out in 2007, I wanted to have a theme of, the character being obsessed with Johnny Cash. And, because his father was obsessed with Johnny Cash. And right. I was going to have that as a theme running all the way through the books in it. And the first one, Fallen Idols, came out. And then I read a Mark Billingham book, one of his Thorn books, where, of course, a character then has, a big Johnny Cash obsession. At that point, I thought, I can't do it anymore because I'm just copying, it looks like I'm copying somebody else. So I had to completely tone it down in the second book. And I did keep the occasional reference to it, just it was consistent that people say, well, hang on, he had a Johnny Cash thing in book one, we've heard nothing about it since. So I did mention it, you know, perhaps putting on an album or something like that, but I had to ditch it because I read a Mark Billingham book. But my dad was obsessed with Johnny Cash.
Right.
So I spent my whole childhood growing up listening to Johnny Cash.
Is that a worry for you that you might write something that somebody's already done before and then you might not know about it? I mean, I have that worry, but I suppose you have to kind of carry on and hope. If you come up with an idea that you think is really clever, then you have to worry. I remember meeting an author once who, he was a science fiction author, and he did this thing on balloons.
Mm.
And he had to make sure that nobody else had done these special kind of science fiction balloons before him. And he was always worried. He said, oh, I've got to write, if any kind of new scientific discovery, like wormholes, came out, he had to rush to write this thing about wormholes before anybody else did. Do you ever worry about that kind of thing happening to you?
To an extent, I can see why it might be perhaps more of a problem with sci-fi.
We're
looking for a real angle on something. With crime, it's not too bad, although I think the biggest panic is not that somebody, that I'll have an idea, then somebody else will have it before me, is that I'll be near to an end of a book, and I'll see something that sounds similar, and I'll start to panic and think, I can't now go back and just scrap everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there were one or two instances where I've seen a book in a bookshop or online, I thought, that sounds a lot like mine. And I've ended up, and the one I'm just finishing. So I've bought the book just to satisfy myself. One, I can argue why it isn't like mine. Or two, so I can just reassure myself that, no, it's all right. It's not like mine at all. Or you might have a very similar title. That's another one.
Titles are always a problem, you
think you've got, oh, that's a good title, and then, you know, you stick with it.
There are 20 other books with it.
Yeah, or very similar.
Yeah.
My book that came out in Harbot last year, Death Collector, That comes out in paperback in May. Then I saw a trailer for the new Lincoln Rhyme book called Skin Collector. I thought, but that will always happen. There are only so many, a crime book is essentially one story, isn't it? Someone or a group of people are killed and people resolve how they died and who did it and how they're going to be captured. I suppose everything else is a variant on that. So it's a fairly limited thing. Whereas I can see with sci-fi, however, where you might come up with something completely unique, like a wormhole or something that really would feel like you had it stolen from you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Are we set to hear? So I think we can hear some more, another tune. All right. Too Much Too Young, The Specials.
Too much too young. You're done too much, much too young. You're married with a kid when you could be having fun with me. You're done too much, much too young. And now you're married with a son when you should be having fun with me.
We don't want no more baby.
And take her home, no we ain't. We slept another fight, another wild first day. You're done too much, much too young. You're married with a kid when you could be having fun with me.
Okay, that was Too Much Too Young by The Specials. Neil, you want to tell us why you've chosen that one in particular?
I think similar to the last song, it represents a certain time, perhaps, well, even before the Scooter years. I suppose The Specials was the band that started my adult life, if you like, in terms of music and being a teenager, and that came out in early 1980s. So I was 14 years of age. Before then, I'd liked sort of some of the punk stuff and not quite so heavy punk stuff like Skids. And, you know, I was sort of around at that time as a young, early teenager, but I just liked it. I wasn't passionate about it. But then I saw The Specials on a TV program, Rock Goes to College, that just blew me away. And so that was it. I was into this whole ska thing and Madness. And from then, everything kind of, I suppose where I am today is because of watching that program, because everything kind of followed on, that the people I met, the path I took, it sort of all stemmed from that kind of scene. So I always see The Specials as the start of, if like the person I became.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's fairly clear that music plays a big part in your life. It's quite important to you because, you know, the way you talk about music, you're quite enthusiastic, but you're also quite knowledgeable about different, musicians and musical heritages. Would you say that informs your writing? Do you listen to music while you write, or do you like perfect silence when you're writing?
I used to do. I was a big fan of BBC Radio 6. But I find it slightly distracting. I try and now do the writing and then listen to music as a relax. But I have written with headphones on and try to write with a musical background.
Yeah.
If I was trying to be smart aleck and trying to come up with a really good snappy answer as to why I became a writer, I'd probably say because I never learned to play the guitar. That would my.
I like it. That's a good answer.
Pithy quote. As an early music fan, what always drew me to music was the. I mean, the Specials weren't the best lyricists, but they were. I was always drawn to bands with great lyrics, and to some extent, maybe more so then than it does now. But it also forms at that point. It formed perhaps my personal politics. You know, it was the end of the 70s, Thatcher was coming to power, Specials were all about racial harmony. It was a good age to come across a band like the Specials, who sort of taught you a lot about, and that kind of music about tolerance and perhaps, sort of lent me more to the left than to the right. And, right. You know, so it had a big influence on me as a person. And yeah, so you can't, and I don't know if I'd turn out any difference if I listened to Motorhead, for example. I don't know. But it must have had some part in forming my own, shaping me as a person.
Yeah.
So that's why it means, I suppose, looking back, it means a lot to me. Cause I know how much I was into it at the time. And when you follow one thing, it leads you into other things. It takes you down a certain path and you never quite know how differently things would have turned out had you chosen somebody else, chosen a different band to like, or a different musical scene to follow, or just done things differently. Could be better, could be worse.
At what point did you decide you wanted to study law then? Because you mentioned, I think, A-levels, that you studied law at A-level. So at some point in time, sort of when you were in your 20s, you must have said, I've decided I want to go into the law. Or was that just, well, I'm just curious about this, I want to just find out more about it or understand it a bit better, or...
It was probably slightly more accidental, perhaps. I remember I was living in Bridlington, and I was on a scheme for the long-term unemployed, and it involved renovating churches, things like that. And there's a guy I worked with called Martin, and he was about 10 years older than I was. And, he left before I did. And I used to see him around, and he said, oh, you know, how are things getting on, Martin? He'd say, oh, you know, I tried this factory, I didn't like it, and I tried that factory, I didn't like that, and I left it. And I just kind of thought, well, that's me in 10 years. So I thought, right, I'm not going down that path. I need to do something else. So I moved back to Wakefield to go back to college. And at that point, I fancied being something like a probation officer. I never thought that a lad like me, working class lad with only one O-level, when it could ever become a lawyer. It just seemed too way beyond me. But so I picked law and sociology with the view to being a probation officer or social worker. And then when I was doing the A-levels, I was supposed to do some voluntary work for the probation service, and I just didn't fancy it, to be honest. I went to a couple of meetings. It just didn't feel like it was something I wanted to do. So my A-level law lecturer said, well, why don't you do a law degree? And I assumed that you needed a handful of qualifications. And he said, no, you do these, you'll get in somewhere. And I did. And so I ended up pursuing a law degree because it was suggested by my A-level law tutor, because what I planned on doing wasn't really working out. And then once I started a law degree at that time, it was a bit of a one track journey. That people who did a law degree back in the early 90s, if they wanted to become a lawyer, they usually could become a lawyer. Mm. I know it's a lot more different now. I wouldn't like to be a young law student now.
But you had to decide at some point whether you wanted to be a solicitor or a barrister, didn't you?
Yeah, that came halfway through. And I always thought I'd be a solicitor. If I ever thought of being a lawyer, when I was thinking about being a lawyer, when I started my law degree, I never imagined myself in a wig and gown, in a court. I imagined myself in a police station.
Yeah.
That's how I always saw myself. Maybe it might be partly a confidence thing that you imagine barristers to be some kind of snooty guy from the country who's going to, come in from his weekend retreat. And I wasn't like that. So
you didn't think you'd fit in there.
Yeah, partly. I mean, I deliberately chose Preston. I did have a place to go at Sheffield University, and I just didn't want to go. I wanted to go somewhere a bit more, how can I put it politely? A bit less high flying. I just thought I'd fit in more, And when I did my Law Society finals at York, I met people there from Oxford and Cambridge, a place like that, and I just didn't feel like I fitted in with them. So I'm glad I chose the path that I did.
Yeah.
Because people at Preston tend to be people who either weren't as ambitious or had failed their A-levels.
Yeah. So when you finished, Did you go in the chambers then? I mean, how did you get involved in the working world? How did you get your first job after you'd finished your training?
Well, once I finished my law degree, I had to do a year law society finals and I did that at York. Right. And then I wrote to all the legal aid firms in the north, mainly northwest, and I ended up getting a training contract at a firm in Manchester.
Was it articles that you did?
They were called articles.
Now they're called training contracts.
So I ended up at a legal aid firm in Manchester. Had 2.5 great years there. Yeah. But I never really settled in Manchester. So I ended up moving back up to this neck of the woods, getting a job with a defence firm in Blackburn. And from there, I ended up joining the prosecution about 16 years ago.
But was it always criminal work that you wanted to do? You never got into conveyancing or probate or any of that other stuff.
As part of my training contract, I did have to do a few wills, which I quite liked actually, because it's almost like puzzle solving. Somebody says that I want my estate to devolve like this, and I had to work out how to do it.
1/6 of this,
Yeah. But on the other hand, because I was only a young trainee, I wasn't giving anything complicated. So I accept that what I did was probably fairly simple.
Wills for multimillionaires.
No. And I did some family work for a while because again, you have to do so many different parts of the law to
that's part
to
of
qualify.
Your training, is it? Part
yeah,
of the,
yeah.
The articles or whatever,
so
yeah.
I did a year doing family work, and childcare, a few months doing crime, following barristers around at the Crown Court, sometimes doing probate. I did about 8 months doing personal injury. But it was always crime I envisaged doing. I don't know why.
Some people don't like it because of the kind of people that you have to deal with. I mean, did you ever sort of have an issue with that, like trying to go down into cells and sort of having to deal with the people like that? Or did you sort of say, I can cope with these people, I can handle them? I don't know. After all, you're defending them, so you're on their side.
I think you do have to construct an argument in your head as to why you're doing it. I used to have this theory that what I used to tell myself that what the law is saying that somebody is guilty because of all the evidence, but they're saying to you, I haven't done it, please help me. And that was my kind of my rationale behind it. It was a fairly weak rationale, to be fair. But I always think in criminals tend to break down into probably three different, equally, into three different parts. There are about a third people do something daft once in their life or every now and again. Another third are your likeable rogues, your bread and butter, people who regularly bother the courts but don't really spread an awful lot of misery. And then there's the other third that are just your hardcore bad guys who just don't have any morality at all. And it was that latter third I had some problems with.
Yeah.
But
have you ever felt threatened? Have you ever felt I'm going to need some help here or...
No.
You're a fairly big lad, and your rugby orientation.
They tend to be all right with the defence lawyers. I think the biggest risk. I mean, then I was fairly young. I didn't get the big cases. I think the biggest risk for defence lawyers is getting sucked into their world. And certainly, my boss at the time, he used to say, "Not there isn't a single client worth giving up your career for." And I've always kept that in mind. You never kind of get sucked into their world. Never kind of. Take something somewhere for if you're asked just keep yourself, stay in your office, be professional, keep your distance. And that's the biggest risk that you get if you're like drawn into their life a bit.
Right. Okay. I think we've got, we're approaching our time. Okay. A Town Called Malice by The Jam.
Time is short, life is cool, but it's time.
Right, that was A Town Called Malice by The Jam. Neil, you want to tell us why you chose that one?
I was just a huge Jam fan. I was a big Jam fan, a big Style Council fan, a big Paul Weller fan. Certainly back then, his lyrics were absolutely bang on. And, you know, and that's almost the perfect song is Town Called Malice. Some of the lyrics in it are just fantastic.
And that takes you back to fond memories, fond time.
Yeah, I mean, only fond because I sort of got through it all. I remember when I first left home in 83, that's when the Style Council was just coming out and they were always the big French thing. And I remember I was unemployed then. And every time I used to get my gyro, if a new Style Council 12-inch was coming out, I'd go buy it and I'd spend all my time just sitting around playing Jam songs. And, you know, that's how I spent how I filled my days, you know. And so it takes me back to a certain time, but I think the Jam was one of the bands that I kind of stuck with even way beyond that time. And when he came back in the early 90s, a solo artist, you know, it was some of the stuff he did then was just fantastic. And I could have picked so many songs to have as my Paul Weller song. Yeah, but that song is, it's just about near perfection.
Right. Wow, great. Let's talk a little bit about your family now, how did you meet your wife and when did that happen? Was that after you finished university, at university?
No, it was at university. That's why I'm still in Preston. She's a Preston girl and she won't leave. So I'm still there. that's where I am now, 20-odd years after. Yeah. No, we're both on the same university course together.
She did law as well?
Yeah, she's a local lawyer as well. We just sort of ended up staying around here because of that, really.
She do criminal work as well?
No, she does just probate kind of work.
Probate and capital. Okay. But you don't both work for the same firm?
No,
you work for different firms.
No. So I'm in Preston. We've got three children
So all of this, when did you actually start? When would you say, because my impression is that you work really hard on your writing and that you write on a regular basis. When did that begin? When did you start sort of saying, I'm going to write every day or I'm going to write regularly and I'm really going to try to do this thing? I'm really going to write a novel. And you wrote a few, I suppose, before you got that first one, Fallen Idol, sort of.
Yeah, well, I suppose you go right back to probably September 1994. I can date it because I know where I was. I was on holiday in the Canaries with Alison and I said, right, I'm going to be a writer. I'd always through university, I'd said, oh, you know, I'll do the law until I can be a writer. I'd started at that point thinking.
Oh, that's when it started to evolve.
Yeah, the germ, nothing more than that, nothing more than this notion that, you know, I quite fancy having a go at writing. I felt it was something I could do. And I said, right, I'm going to be a writer.
Were you serious about that from the word go? Or was it just kind of jokey, like, oh, I'm going to be a writer, but.
It was a 50-50. I mean, it was something jokey. I used to say, I'll just do the law until I can be a writer. But it was, I was starting to think about plots and it was something I definitely intended to do. But I didn't start until I was on holiday in 94, just because by then all the exams had finished. I was doing my training contract. So I went to the local shop in Fuerteventura. I bought a pad of paper, a pen, and I sort of sketched out the first four pages of what I thought would be the next great British crime novel. I spent about 3 years realizing it was absolute rubbish. I tried to work out why it was rubbish. And I realized that I'd done 400 pages. I had no idea what it was about. I had no idea how it would finish. So I realized it needed some structure. And, I saw a documentary on Steven Spielberg and about the way he constructs a story. And I bought a few self-help books. I bought a good one by John Brain who talked about how to write and people like that. And what Steven Spielberg said was that if he does a storyboard, he has an idea of how long each single scene will take. So he'll say a particular scene that will be 27 seconds long.
All right.
And his mantra, it doesn't matter how well film is going. If he says 27 seconds, that's how long that scene will be, and that's it. Because that's how he sees a story balancing out.
Yeah.
So I realised that one, I need to construct a story, but it gave me a notion of how to balance it. So I sketched out this time, rather than sort of thinking the story will tell itself, which of course the story doesn't tell itself.
No.
You've got to somehow know what's coming next. And if I ever get stuck when I'm writing, I realise it's because I don't know what's coming next. So I have to sit down and have a period of planning. But I sketched out, a few, pages of a plot idea, then I slowly fleshed it out until it became a 10,000 word document, this long, convoluted story. And that had broken down into chapters and scenes. And then I allocated so many words to each scene. That if it was if something's a major scene, well, it's got to be important. So I'll make that one, for example, 5,000 words. That's a minor scene, but I'll sort of make it 1,000 words. And then I realised that in a crime book, 5,000 words is quite a slog. Yeah. So I tried thinking of scenes to break it up. And that had the effect of shifting the attention, you know, keeps the reader interested, hopefully. But then it would then break that big scene up. And what it did, having a word count per scene, was that as a writer, if I wrote, 2,000 words on a scene that I said should be 1,000 words long, I knew I had to get rid of 1,000. Right. So it helped me edit. But also, if I...
quite disciplined there.
But this was before I got a publishing contract. This was me learning to write.
It's good. It's a learning process. It's good to be disciplined in that way.
So if I'd said I needed a scene that was 5,000 words long and I'd only written 2,500, well, I had another 2,500 to find. So that helped me kind of, if you like, not pad scenes out, but find a way of adding more words in nothing else.
Yeah.
And also knowing how the story ended helped me finish that story.
So when you're setting out to write a book before you put pen to paper, if metaphorically, do you know the ending before you begin? Do you know where you're going?
Yeah, I tend to know the ending. Often the part I find hardest is joining what I've done to the ending that I've got in mind.
Yeah. The journey there then.
Yeah, I tend to know how it's going to, cause I tend to know what it's about. And I tend to know how I want it to resolve. And then I usually find, I'll then plan it out a fifth at a time. Just because I need to get going. So I'll get about a fifth into it, then I'll start to plan the next bit. And then about halfway through, I think, right, I need to somehow get from where I am now to, like, if you like, the beginning of the end. And that's the bit when I find the hardest, because I'm in my head, I haven't perhaps joined everything together, so I need to sort of link everything in then, and that's the bit that I struggle the most at. But I always do tend to have, you know, I might have a location in mind, I might have a manner of conclusion, how somebody's going to die or not die, or how they're going to be caught, or will they be caught, or, you know, I mean, have some kind of, the end is usually there. It's just getting to the, he's working well, out I know, how to get to that point.
I know in many of your books, you have characters who've appeared in earlier books, and that's part of your forte, if you will. But when you're doing all this design, have you got the characters kind of firmly set in your mind, of even the minor characters? Or is it more, this is the story I want to tell, and I will put in police sergeants or mortuary attendants or whoever needs to be in to make the story work?
Probably the latter. I mean, I quite often change secondary characters. You know, I might come across somebody in my daily life and think, oh, well, perhaps I don't like. I think, well, they're going in.
Yeah. Revenge.
I'm sick of you today. You're
going in. You're one of the bad guys.
Insult me. You're getting killed tomorrow. You know. I might have, for example, you might be doing a mortuary scene. So you'll need a mortuary attendant. You know, and it's easy to, let's have the cliche of some kind of, a guy with long black hair and like a heavy metal t-shirt, you know, all that, I think those kind of things. But then you might come across somebody, you think, oh, that person, he or she would be really good for that character. So you might shoehorn them in.
You know, Sherlock Holmes, Conan Doyle, he, one of his enemies at school was Moriarty. He was named Moriarty.
Oh, right.
That was a real person. It was just a school friend. Well, friend in quotes. Yeah. But I think writers do that.
On the whole, if you recognise yourself in one of my books, I don't like you.
Have you ever been? You haven't been sued much,
no,
then.
No, I'm not prepared to admit who's who, but if it's a character that isn't to be liked, and you recognise yourself in it, I don't like you either.
Okay. Right. Okay. I'll be careful. I'll watch my P's and Q's then. Are we ready for another tune then? Okay. Okay. This charm, after all that, we're going to listen to This Charming Man by the Smiths. Okay, Neil, that was This Charming Man, the Smiths. A reason for that?
It's just a great song.
Oh, right. Okay, just, you just like it.
They're just a great band. They're very evocative of the Northwest. Some of his lyrical imagery fits the Northwest and Manchester and all the sort of moonlights at the reservoirs, all that kind of thing. I think Morris is fantastic, and This Charming Man just a great song. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's get back to you then about, sort of your past and your, I'm interested in your writing routine. Would you say that you have a writing routine? Are you fairly strict with yourself? You get up like early in the morning and you write, or you write in the evenings or all the time, or?
It's probably all the time, but not really, in the sense that whenever I get up, I intend to spend the day writing.
Yeah.
Now, I might spend half the day looking at online newspapers, rugby league forums, suddenly deciding that nothing I need to do more than watch the film that I've got in my Sky Planner, but every day I intend to get up and spend the day writing. And I still work 3 days a week as a lawyer. And even on those nights, I get home from work and I intend to sit down and write. Sometimes I can. Sometimes I can't. Sometimes I'm just too mentally tired. But the weird thing is, you never quite know when it's going to hit you. For example, you might feel great and up for it and feel enthused, and then you sit down at your computer and nothing comes out, and you might just spend all your time messing around on the internet. But not other. This happened last week. I was tired. I'd been at work all day. I thought, no, I'll just try and progress this another, even if it's just a few hundred words, if it just takes it a bit further forward, then I've made some progress. I did over 1,000 words, and it was quite, and once I started, It just came quite easy. So you never quite know.
I appreciate that. Yeah. I understand. The same is true with me. But you don't sort of say, I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock and I'm going to write from 5 until 8 before I go into work or any of that sort of thing in the mornings.
If I'm quite near a deadline, I'll perhaps, or if I think I've got in a regular rhythm, because one of the hard things about writing a book is the interruptions of editing, in that, you know, I might have a book contract where I've got to write a book a year, and then you'll start to get some progress, and then some edits of your last book will then land on your mat, so you might spend a month doing those, so it can be interrupted, but then eventually you get into the flow of you're only writing one book. And so if I'm in a regular flow, I'm writing sort of most days, I'll sometimes, before I go to work, I might just edit or go through what I did the night before. And I do tend to find that some of the best edits are done at that time, because you're fresh. You've just, you know, you're doing it quickly, and you do tend to improve quite a lot in the morning what you did the night before. Often later on, you think it's great, and then the cold light and all that, you know,
yes,
what pretentious nonsense. So it is actually quite a good time, but I wish I could be disciplined enough to get myself up on when I'm not at work and say, right, I'm now going to spend 4 hours. Because I know I've got 18 hours ahead of me in the day, I'll think, well, I can do it later.
But it's deadlines that really put the pressure on, would you say, that really make you get, if you know that someone is expecting this to be done at a certain time, then you will say, well, I've got to get down and do it.
I don't think I've ever missed a deadline. Maybe it's part of the legal thing that I'm used to doing things to timescales at work.
Yeah.
That I'm better. If someone says, I need this by June, they'll have it by June. If they said, just send it in when it's finished, it could take me 3 years.
Who sets that? I mean, does the publisher sort of say, okay, you've written this book and we need to have a book every year.
Mm.
And therefore, let's say today's April 24th, April 24th next year, we expect you to you'd obviously have to hand the book in before that, wouldn't you? Because they have to read it. So will they say, you've got 6 months from today, we want a book in our hands, a manuscript in our hands,
tends to be yearly. That if I signed a contract now, for example, and they had one I just finished, I'd probably come to an agreement to submit one by end of next February. Because I'd have just started the next one anyway. You know, and that means them receiving a manuscript they're prepared to publish. And which then goes through the editing processes, copy edits, line edits, all those.
So it's probably going to be more than a year before it actually comes out, before it's actually appears.
Each book probably takes 18 months from start to finish.
18 months, okay.
Except the last 6 months is, spaced out where
you might have a three week concerted
stint at some line edits or some copy edits. And equally the first 6 months will be broken up by the edits of the previous one. So you have to have a broken 6 months, a concerted 6 months, a broken 6 months. That's how it tends to go. But it is one a year. And so people are different. Some people, perhaps get extensions on deadlines. I tend to prefer deadlines. If I prefer the pressure of being forced to do it.
It makes you do it.
I'm the sort of person, if I'm at work, if I've got a pile of 10 files on my desk, then I'll go like the clappers on the first 6 or 7. Get the last 2. I can do those tomorrow. I never, ever clear my desk. I'll need someone to say, you can't go until you clear those, and then I will do it. But I can do the last 2 tomorrow, you know, so I need the pressure of a deadline. Yeah.
I had a friend who was reading my book, and he said, I'm going to nobble your knees if you don't finish this. So I needed to be threatened, I think, to finish mine. it isn't easy to doing that process of trying to get it all done and dusted and all that. You never work on 2 books at the same, well, other than the editing process. You don't actually write 2 books at the same
time. No, I do tend to, even if I'm not writing, I'm always thinking about what I can add into it. So, no, I can't imagine myself having 2 books being written parallel. I think I would have to focus entirely on one book. And I might not spend all my time writing it, but I'll certainly spend a lot of my time thinking about it.
And you don't use a pseudonym as another... You don't have a, like, 2 writing sort of genres. You don't write in a genre. Some authors do that. They have different sort of historical or romance or whatever they write.
Yeah. It's only ever been crime. It was always crime that drew me. Cause it's what I read.
Yeah.
My starting intention was to write a book that I'd want to read. That, and in fact, when I first started writing, and I used to print off the page, I used to try, I tried to imagine I just paid £7 from Waterstones. I think, right, would I be happy spending £7 on this? And that was my, that was how I used to, take a step back from it and look at it coldly and clinically and thinking, would I be content with that?
Was it mostly modern crime fiction that you read, or did you go back and start with Sherlock Holmes and Father Brown and all of those sort of, early crime fiction? Edgar Allan Poe or whatever.
Yeah, no,
I tend to, this
sounds really bad as a writer, doesn't it?
No,
I'm a bit of a lazy reader, if I'm honest. I tend to read in the same way I watch films. Like, if I watch a film, I want the light off, I want headphones on, I want to sit there and let the film do the work, if you like, be drawn into that world. And I don't enjoy a book if I have to sit there and concentrate at it and really, I just want to find myself flicking the pages,
right,
and suddenly ending up at page 300 and not quite sure where the time's gone. That's how I see, for me, that's a sign of a book I'm enjoying. People like Lee Child and are very good at it. You know, you just enjoy, you know, enjoy turning the pages.
But it's all writers who are writing now that you read. Yeah. Even Agatha Christie, you wouldn't sort of read
I've read those when I was younger. I read Sherlock Holmes when I was younger. I read some Ellery Queen when I was younger. Now I tend to prefer American crime fiction.
Right.
I think that's partly because I won't be caught out by any procedural errors in the law, for example.
Okay.
And I get frustrated by, if I read a mistake, that's such a rudimentary mistake in perhaps a legal process. Now, there might be the same number of mistakes in American fiction, but I don't know. I'm an English lawyer, so it enables me to just sort of get lost in the story.
And right.
I also think it takes you somewhere else, somewhere different, somewhere sunnier, more exciting, you know, more violent.
The world of crime fiction is divided into different types of crime fiction, like police procedural. I'm sure you know all this. Do you think of yourself as writing in any particular type of crime fiction? You know, like hardboiled. There's hardboiled fiction, there's police procedural, all of that. Or do you just say, I'm going to write crime fiction, and if part of it's hardboiled and part of it's police procedural, that's okay with me? Or do you try to sort of stick to a particular type?
I didn't try to write to a subgenre. I first tried to mimic a style of a non-crime writer. The first writing I did, I tried to mimic the style of W.P. Kinsella, who wrote the book that became the film Field of Dreams. And then I sort of tried to adapt that a bit. And I just ended up, I suppose a serial killer is probably the subgenre that I first started writing in. Now they're of a similar vein, but slightly more legal. And I've started incorporating more law in them now because when I first started writing, I tried to avoid the law completely. Because I found myself, for example, John Grisham, I quite enjoy the legal ins and outs, but I found myself wanting to be too accurate.
Yeah.
But something that accurate isn't always interesting. So I shied away from that. Now I feel confident enough to tackle it now, that I can hopefully make it interesting. But when I first started out, I was all about the detail.
I think he's got a denial. I think in the back of one of his books, he sort of says, look, I'm a lawyer and I write about lawyers and I write about crime and that, but please don't write to me and say I've got this wrong or that wrong or the other thing wrong. This is fiction and I'm going to do what I want. And I don't need correcting. Thank you very much.
Yes.
So anyway, a last tune. The Broad Majestic Shannon by the Pogues.
The last time I saw you was down at the Greeks. There was whiskey and sunburn and tears in her cheeks. She sang me a song that was pure as the breeze and a road leading up Glenavie. I sat for a while at the Crescent Finner where young lovers would meet when the flowers were in bloom. Heard the men coming from the fire at Chiron, their hearts in Tipperary, wherever they go. Take care and dry your tears, babe. Take my hand, forget your fears, babe. There's no pain, there's no more sorrow. They've all gone in. In the wall from a rusty tin cannon.
hurt's been felt and the rosary call in a footprint shunting out. And the next time I see you, we'll down at the grace. There'll be whiskey and Sunday and tears in our cheeks. For stupid to laugh and it's useless to fall. But Rusty's in cannon and all our equal.
Okay, that was The Broad Majestic Shannon by the Pogues. Neil, have you got a reason for that one?
A big Pogues fan. I like folk music. I just wanted to pick a song of the Pogues that was, one, had no swearing in, which that was a bit tricky to find. But also just that I thought it, lyrically it was good. It had a nice folky feel to it. I like a lot of folk music. And so it was just purely finding one of their songs I thought summed up that folky kind of folky feel.
Okay, Neil, well, we've come to the end of our time, unfortunately, because I've really, really enjoyed it, found it invaluable, what you've said. Really interesting, and I think any prospective writer who happens to listen to what you've said can sort of be well advised to listen to some of your approaches.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
I'm glad you've enjoyed it. Thank you for coming and taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you.